Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Speaking at an annual Singapore security conference today, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter delivers a blunt rebuke to China for reclamation efforts in the disputed South China Sea.
With its actions in the South China Sea, China is out of step with both the international rules and norms that underscore the Asia-Pacific security architecture and the regional consensus that favors diplomacy and opposes coercion. These actions are spurring nations to respond together in new ways, in settings as varied as the East Asia Summit to the G7.
A Chinese military official also attending the annual security conference called Secretary Carter's remarks groundless and not constructive. An extremely powerful earthquake rocked the Pacific Ocean floor today about 900 kilometers south of Tokyo. Scientists say there's no danger of a tsunami because the quake was centered 600 or more kilometers below the surface. The U.S. Geological Survey measured the earthquake at a magnitude 7.8, roughly as powerful as the quake that devastated Nepal last month, while Japan's meteorological agency pegged the quake as an even stronger jolt of 8.5 magnitude. The nearest inhabited areas were small islands scattered over a wide area of that North Pacific region. Boko Haram has killed 13 people and wounded 17 more in an attack on a residential area of Maiduguri in Nigeria's Borno state. One resident said he counted 40 explosions Friday night before he stopped tracking the rocket-propelled grenades being launched by insurgents. Witnesses say after the attack, members of an armed youth group took to the streets to prevent the Boko Haram militants from advancing on the villagers. This is VOA News. More than 4,200 migrants have been rescued in one day off Libya's coast, attempting the crossing in the search of a better life in European countries, according to Italian authorities. The Coast Guard of Italy, assisted by the Italian Navy, German, Irish, Belgian, and British ships, all made rescues in 22 separate operations. The Coast Guard said it also found 17 bodies in one of the fishing boats and some rubber dinghies. Nationalities of the victims and circumstances of those deaths remain unknown, but Italian officials have often described grim conditions, exhaustion, thirst, exposure, and violence as the cause. The United States has officially removed Cuba from its list of state sponsors of terrorism, and that is being celebrated in Cuba, as VOA's Zlatika Hoke reports.
The United States announced the decision Friday, saying it is effective immediately. For many Cubans, the decision means righting a long-time injustice.
Luckily, they realized, they opened their eyes, that we are not bad.
Cuba was placed on the list in 1982 for aiding rebel movements in Africa and Latin America. But Havana long ago said it had ceased supporting foreign insurgencies. Cuban President Raul Castro made the removal a key condition for restoring diplomatic relations with Washington. Some U.S. lawmakers oppose rapprochement with the communist country. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
President Obama is stepping up pressure on the U.S. Senate ahead of tomorrow's debate on surveillance powers of the National Security Agency, which are set to expire.
So we now have Democrats and Republicans in both the House and the Senate who think this is the right way to go. We've got our law enforcement and national security teams and civil liberties proponents and advocates who say this is the right way to go.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is insisting on an extension of the so-called Patriot Act surveillance programs, including the collection of American telephone records, in spite of strong bipartisan support in the Senate for the House-passed reform bill called the USA Freedom Act. President Obama says he needs to remind everyone that at midnight Sunday, a whole range of authorities that the U.S. intelligence community uses to track terrorists will expire. Sepp Blatter has easily won a fifth term as president of football's governing body, FIFA, on Friday, in spite of arrests earlier in the week of 14 FIFA officials on corruption charges and the announcement of twin corruption investigations into FIFA practices from both the U.S. and Switzerland. U.S. prosecutors say sports media executives paid or agreed to pay millions of dollars to FIFA officials in exchange for marketing rights to tournaments. Switzerland, meantime, is conducting a separate probe into Russia's bid for the 2018 World Cup and Qatar's bid for the 2022 Cup. The two countries are scheduled to host the next two events and are denying any wrongdoing. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The meeting is expected to assess the situation in Burundi and possibly come up with a roadmap on how best to resolve the standoff.
East African heads of state meet in Tanzania on Sunday to find a solution to the Burundi crisis.
The economy of Uganda cannot sustain to prop up a regime in Sudan. And ours was an advisory note that government should do all it can.
Ugandan opposition lawmakers demand the withdrawal of the country's troops from South Sudan.
I'm skeptical about how they have acquired those petitions. In Rwanda, of course, you might know that the way the government operates.
Our Rwandan lawmakers will soon consider amending the constitution to allow President Paul Kagame to seek another term. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. African regional leaders are expected to meet in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania on Sunday. High on the agenda is a discussion on a report on the current situation in Burundi. Asa Mwambini, a spokesman for the government of Tanzania, told me earlier that the leaders will try to find solutions at the summit to end the crisis in Burundi.
I can only confirm to you that yes, the summit will be held in Dar es Salaam under the chairmanship of the President Jakaya Mrisho Kikwete, the Tanzanian president. It will basically, deliberate on the report of the chair of the Minister's Council, who went on a fact-finding mission in Burundi. So basically, the meeting is expected to assess the situation in Burundi and possibly come up with a roadmap on how best to resolve the standoff.
Some people have expressed concern, including civil society groups, saying that the regional leaders must act now before the situation degenerates into worsening violence and possible ethnic cleansing or genocide. What do you say to such concerns?
Well, you must also remember that even the heads of state, when they met 2 weeks ago, they also expressed deep concern with the escalating violence in Burundi. And so it's not new. And when they meet, they will definitely do the same. But the most important aspect is that we are only seeing that the way forward in resolving the conflict in Burundi is for the warring parties to come to terms to reject violence as a move to, to demand whatever they demand in Burundi. So we don't expect the heads of state to come up with standing care if the two warring parties in Burundi are not willing at all, to set aside and say violence no more.
Are there any indications that President Nkurunziza will attend this meeting, looking at the fact that the last time he attended, there was an attempted coup behind him? Are there indications that he would attend this time?
This is the EAC meeting, and it is a summit that involves all the heads of state. So the Burundian president, as one of the heads of state in the EAC, would most likely be one of them because it is a summit for heads of state.
What should the people of Burundi expect from these leaders in the East African community, especially when the situation appears to be rather tense? There has been a bomb blast yesterday. Commissioners of the Electoral Commission have resigned and crossed the border to neighboring Rwanda. Among the lots of refugees that are also trooping into Tanzania, Rwanda, and Uganda, for that matter.
Well, first we must say that the heads of state provided a roadmap that has to be followed by the two warring parties in Burundi, and so we expect possibly that the heads of state would strengthen and possibly say in a more high tone to ensure that ceiling, but also that the warring parties respect the constitution of Burundi, because that's the only solution to the Burundi crisis. If anybody would claim that he is right, and if the other party also claims that he is right, and if it is not within the mandate of the Burundian constitution, and it is not within the framework of the Burundi legal base, there won't be peace in Burundi, and even if you have heads of state meeting many times.
Asa Mwambene is the spokesman for the government of Tanzania. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. A Ugandan parliamentary report suggests that the presence of Ugandan troops in South Sudan is unsustainable and a financial drain on the economy. The report by the Parliament's Committee on Defense and Internal Affairs also encourages the government to work with regional and international partners to help stabilize the situation in South Sudan. Opposition parliamentarian Mwanga Kivumbi Muhammad told me that troops should be withdrawn immediately.
The committee report looks at budgetary implications of our stay in South Sudan and realized that in the short and long term, it's not sustainable. The economy of Uganda cannot sustain to prop up a regime in Sudan. And ours was an advisory note that government should do all it can to find ways and means of cooperating with the other regional bodies so that on its own we can have a withdrawal from South Sudan. The major propeller of that reason and understanding is the realization that our basket or resource envelope is so spread thin to sustain that huge operation in Sudan, and in our considered opinion, all ways should be explored to ensure we withdraw from South Sudan.
But how much money are we talking about here?
You will see the Ugandan government minister of defense budget. They're hoping 1.5 trillion in shillings. I don't know, in terms of dollars, it comes to like 800 to 900 US dollars. 900 million US dollars, just a minister of defense. And out of that budget component, 600 billion, almost more than a third of the budget, is underclassified. This is a budget component that ideally goes to support operations that are covered like those in Sudan. In our humble view, going forward, this classified budget has been expanding for the last 3 years. It was 180, it went to 300, it has now gone to 600. When you look at the agenda that the government has presented, another 35 billion will be added to that classified budget expenditure. So, therefore, and at the expense of the welfare of the men and women in the armed forces, they still can't have decent barracks. They are still not well paid. They are still not having good return. We are having a huge problem with how to retire our aged. Over and above that, you realize you cannot afford to spend that kind of money in South Sudan. The cover that a certain section of the budget on fuel component, as per the official document, the only component that the government of South Sudan needs is too small to plug that whole gap. And we think the prudent thing to do in the interest of our country and our poor people is to devise ways and means to get out of Sudan. The sooner, the better.
Mwanga Kivumbi Muhammad is a Ugandan opposition lawmaker. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, Simon Mulongo, a ruling NRM legislator, says he sharply disagrees with the call for the withdrawal of the UPDF troops from South Sudan.
No, I do not, because for two reasons or three. The first one is that the national security of Uganda is heavily dependent on the security of South Sudan. And the cost of insecurity in this country could definitely be much more than the cost of maintaining the contingent in South Sudan. Secondly, the cost is not that as enormous because The UPDF forces in South Sudan are utilizing operational costs ordinarily they would have incurred in Uganda. For example, they don't eat much extra food because they're in South Sudan. They're not expending ammunition as much as people imagine in South Sudan, because these forces in South Sudan are not necessarily involved in active fighting. They have maintained positions and guarding strategic installations, both in the capital and some provincial cities in the countryside. And I think some of the key areas, like a few oil production centers, they have not been involved in the active fighting alongside the South Sudan forces with the rebel groups. So surely the opposition have not been able to, for example, come out with specific numbers to say that this is the money being expended and that is having a huge impact on the finances. So sure, and in this time, the government came up with a request to spend more money in various departments and agencies, and the military request was far below the demands of other agencies, which is 16 billion only. And this not to say that we're going for South Sudan operations, because we have missions in Central Africa, we have missions in Somalia that require support from government. So surely the South Sudan situation is being exaggerated.
So are you therefore saying that the opposition is just making noise for that matter, and that the taxpayers are not being necessarily billed, or for that matter, South Sudan is not being asked to pay its fair share of the presence of UPDF forces there to help their country, to stabilize their country?
As Parliament, we did insist that we must ensure that the status of forces agreement with South Sudan should include the portion where they would supplement the finance costs of the forces in South Sudan. And indeed, they did that. In January or February last year, the South Sudan government reviewed the status of forces agreement with Uganda and took the bills of fuel. So any fuel being used in South Sudan, whether by aerial resources or ground resources, are purely being met by South Sudan. And that's one. And the other one is that we managed to reopen economic activity between South Sudan and Uganda generally, and that is giving us a huge economic boost. So looking at the net cost benefit, Uganda is benefiting more than any cost we're incurring in terms of that. And finally, of course, we managed to ensure that there's no genocide occurring in South Sudan. If we look at the two major groups in South Sudan, the Dinkas and then the other counterparts, maybe they would have killed each other already. As the magnitude perhaps greater than that of Rwanda. So I think it is not correct to be emotional on this. We need to talk about facts. They have not given us any figures whatsoever. They are talking from points of assumption, and we cannot make strategic decisions based on simply such guesswork.
Does that mean that what the parliamentary committee report basically is neither here nor there, since the government will do what it wants to do anyway, despite the report expressing concern about the high cost of the UPDF presence in South Sudan?
Surely the issue, the report did actually state the concern that it is taking much longer to resolve the South Sudan crisis. And Uganda is perhaps the only country that has deployed a certain level of forces there. And the issue is that we would like to see an end to this, and that we would like to see the regional initiative take root in South Sudan, either IGAD or African Union. And that was the spirit around which the committee made that recommendation. Not that we are saying because it's too expensive, or that we should withdraw. Surely it will not be correct for us to state that without numbers, and to take that without having certain alternative arrangements for our national security. We do not actually have that kind of recommendation. The opposition could be doing that because they will be happy to see the country in trouble. But for us who like to see continued stability in the country and fostering our national security, we have to recommend options that will make it easier to be resolved without necessarily compromising our national security.
Simon Molongo is a Ugandan legislator from the ruling NRM. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala.
Rwandan Parliament has announced it will soon debate modifying the country's constitution in order to allow President Paul Kagame to stand for a third term in the 2017 presidential election. The debate is a result of petitions signed by nearly 2 million Rwandans who say they are in favor of changing the constitution. David Himbara is a former Rwandan senior government official. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Toronto, Canada for his reaction.
I'm skeptical about how they have acquired those petitions. In Rwanda, of course, you might know that the way the government operates, you have the smallest administrative unit in Rwanda. We have what you call umudugudu, sometimes known as nyumba kumi. So every 10 houses is observed. So if they're told to do A, B, C, D, they really have no choice but to abide by the authorities. So it's quite easy to just have the millions people sign because they're ordered. That's what has happened.
So in that case, then, what's the value of the constitution having put term limits?
I think this is even crude, even somewhat, even though it may appear sophisticated. The most surprising thing about Rwanda is that the people who are leading the constitutional change to allow President Kagame to stay in power the opposition parties themselves. Some of the political parties began to campaign for Kagame as far back as like 2 years ago. Basically, in Rwanda, you have a kind of totalitarian state. The media, for example, there's no media in Rwanda. There is zero opposition. All the opposition have been swallowed up. The real opposition in Rwanda, the opposition leaders are either in prison or they've been killed, or they're in exile. So this extraordinary machinery that has bulldozed. But I think this one is in a category of its own. Even that sophistication of saying, wow, you know, look, by the way, Kagame himself is on the record to say he does not belong to the camp that is calling for constitutional change.
This trend on the continent, it's spreading. Many people have whispered or analysts have mentioned that maybe for Rwanda, it was a foregone conclusion that the constitution would be changed and Mr. Kagame would have another term. Are you, like all those analysts, not surprised by this development?
No. I'm not surprised at all. First of all, I don't know if people have actually paid close attention to the Rwandan constitution. That constitution itself, of course, written under supervision of Kagame and the ruling party in 2003, that constitution is extraordinary. You don't have a constitution like that in Africa or anywhere. First of all, it gave him 7 years times two, 14 years. Number two, of the three components of government, of the state, the legislature and the Senate, the judiciary, and the executive, the Rwandan constitution allows only one term for chief justice and only one term for the president of the Senate. So only the president. So already that constitution made him a king. Not only that, that parliament, by the way, is not elected. Don't think that those parliamentarians have a constituency anywhere. No, there's a party's list. The party's list, and of course it's a ruling party, the list, basically appointed by Kagame, and then there are the junior parties that are affiliated to him. But and as I said, the genuine parties are not registered. The constitution also says that the agenda of any session of parliament, or even its committee, president has to approve. The senators are appointed by the provinces and city executives. But guess who appoints the executives? The president. So that is a king. So already, it's a done deal.
David Himbara is a former Rwandan senior government official. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Toronto, Canada. Lawmakers in the Democratic Republic of Congo have called on the U.S. to name a new envoy to the Great Lakes region to replace the retired Rice Feingold. In a letter to President Barack Obama, they say the envoy is needed to counter renewed insecurity in the region. For VOA, Nick Long reports from Goma.
10 Congolese parliament members from opposition parties and the ruling coalition signed the letter to President Barack Obama, which was made public this week. In it, they ask him to again place Africa's Great Lakes region high on his agenda in view of renewed insecurity and the risk of an upsurge of Islamist terrorism in the region. The lawmakers note massacres that have claimed more than 400 lives since October and a surge of kidnappings in eastern DRC, as well as the recent turmoil in Burundi. They suggest this might be the prelude to yet another rebellion in Congo, which could undo the work of former US Special Envoy Russ Feingold, who the lawmakers credit with playing a key role in the defeat of the M23 rebellion in Congo in 2013. The letter ends with an appeal to the president to appoint a new special envoy to the region soon. One of the signers, Deputy Juvenal Munubo Mubi of the opposition UNC party, told VOA he thought Feingold did a good job and is appreciated by the people in the region.
Il a maintenu les contacts avec les dirigeants à Kinshasa, à Kigali, à Kampala, à Bujumbura.
He says Feingold maintained contact with leaders in the region in Kinshasa, Kigali, Kampala and Bujumbura and repeatedly emphasized the need to bring an end to the M23 rebellion, as well as the need to deal with the question of the Rwandan FDLR rebels. Good relations between the DRC and Rwanda have in the past been vital to security in the region, and Mubi said it was time to pay more attention to the two countries' cross-border security. There are good reasons to be vigilant, he says, because there are reports of suspicious movements at the frontier between Congo's North Kivu province and Rwanda. Mubi says he doesn't believe every rumour, but he points to a statement last month by the governor of North Kivu province, Julien Paluku, who told media that Rwandan soldiers had crossed the border and exchanged fire with Congolese troops. Rwanda has denied that its troops made an incursion. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Now turning to West Africa, tens of thousands of people are fleeing their homes in northern Mali as clashes between pro- and anti-government armed groups escalate. The UN Refugee Agency reports many of the newly displaced have seen their houses looted and burned and their shops and livestock pillaged. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has this report from the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The number of internally displaced people in Mali, which had been going down, is again surging upwards. Before the recent escalation of fighting, 43,000 people had not returned to the homes they fled after civil war broke out in 2012. Now, the total number of displaced has increased to just over 100,000. The UN Refugee Agency reports fighting between the government and various rebel groups is centered in the Gao, Mopti, and Timbuktu areas of northern Mali. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler tells VOA the armed groups are a complex, motley mixture of pro-government militia, Tuareg separatists, and ethnically based militias.
This deterioration of the security situation takes place just days after the signing of the Algeria peace agreement between the government and several of the armed groups in Bamako on the 15th of May. So obviously this deterioration of the security conditions is very worrying. We're following it closely. But again, our main emphasis and priority are the civilian populations that are being displaced.
The newly displaced tell aid workers they fled their villages because of fear of violence or forced recruitment by armed groups. Spindler says many are sleeping outdoors and some are staying with friends or relatives in neighboring villages. He says many displaced women and children urgently need shelter, water, and food.
We have great difficulty having access to the area. Information is very scarce. We have received some information from our teams on the ground, but they are operating under very difficult conditions because of the security. We don't always have access to many of these places. We have done some distributions of aid.
In addition to internal displacement, the UNHCR reports small numbers of refugees are crossing to neighboring countries following the renewed violence. Since January, it says 3,500 new refugees have gone to Mali, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, and Niger. Although the numbers are relatively low, Spindler says they are worrying because they seem to be reversing a trend of returns. The Mali government estimates more than 35,000 refugees have returned home since 2013. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Right now, it's time for music from African Collection. Enjoy.
Some of them never know me. Some of them don't know me. Some of them keep for me. Every time the people don't sing, some of them wanna whine for me. Some of them boogie down for me. But love the way the ladies will whine for me. Everybody now, let go. Everybody go. I like the way you do it.
You see, I got the blessing. Yeah, yeah. Ooh, oh, no, be Martin. Savanna long thing. God, you know, go greed that one for me. Ooh, oh, who know this Martin? Savanna long thing. God, you know, go greed that one for me. Man a get grimy, girl a enjoy me. Said that the rhythm me just shows headline me. Able one sign me, no boy can't buy me. Man a bad man, FBI can't find me. One time me look clean and shiny. Me forget the time, but me Rolex remind me. Real bad man, them from Baghdad behind me. Focus on the matter, never bad design me. To a man, these guys and girls, we getting money. Money, money. So my money guys and girls, don't get in money. Money, money. I've been looking, I've been searching. Yeah, yeah. Man hustle, man I'm working. Yeah, yeah. But I be ordinary blessing. Wait till you see, now God be blessing. Yeah, yeah. Ooh, oh, who know be smarting? Savannah long thing. God, you know, go greed that one for me. Ooh, oh, who know be smarting? Savannah long thing. God, you know, go greed that one for me. Second balance and the safe as that and then go Canada. Then they holler my name from here to Canada. Give them 30 with long we bend like banana. Second balance and the safe as that and then go Canada. Then they holler my name from here to Canada. Give them 30 with long we bend like banana.
What do you want from the bank? I just say come from the bank. And I got money to throw it, throw it. So everybody who yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Rockin' the body, rockin' the body, rockin' the body for me. Keep rockin' the body, rockin' the body for me.
Yeah, I go, oh, yeah, I go. It's time to show me your love.
started giving the money like give me handouts. Yeah. Now my destiny to stand out. I'm all down, no shit, when I go find out. Yeah. Them things say I go die out. Whether you like it or not, I go to the cash out. Some blessing will never dry out.
Shine a brand new designer, that type you see on that fashion.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure to share my reflections on U.S. policy toward the continent of Africa. Simultaneously, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. Every week, I pay close attention to how the African media and the American media focus on this relationship. Burundi has been very much in the news, and of course, U.S. policymakers have devoted some time to what is going on over there. But I think the most important development this week is the inauguration of the president of Nigeria, former General Buhari, who is now the democratically elected president of Nigeria, is in power now. This has serious implications for U.S. policy towards Africa. And the American government plays a very important role in helping the Nigerians negotiate the difficult problems of state building and nation building. The president of the United States sent a delegation to witness this very important development in Nigerian history. As you look at this new development in American relations with Nigeria, a number of issues come to mind. And some of these issues are very clear in the inaugural speech of President Buhari. State building and nation building are very much part of the narrative. 3 points should be emphasized with regard to this new development in Nigerian history. If you go back to the founding of Nigeria as a republic in 1960 to now, you can see that the Nigerians have traveled a long way to where they are now. In 1960, the Nigerian leaders tried to solve the problem of state building and nation building. The idea of Nigeria was the work of Lugard, the English colonial organizer for the British Empire. So since Nigeria emerged at the very beginning of the last century, 1914 to now, if you look at that period to now, you have over 100 years of development. The English were in Nigeria before the establishment of what is called Nigeria. And political engineering of Nigerian leaders, from Lugard to all the colonial governors who tried to establish Nigeria, to the assumption of the presidency of Nigeria by Nnamdi Azikiwe, and before that, the prime ministership based on the Westminster model, you have the golden voice of Nigeria, Sir Abubakar Tafawa Balewa. Since then, when they had a coup d'etat, the political stage in Nigeria has become more and more and more complicated. So we should see the assumption of power by Buhari as a tale of two narratives. When Buhari assumed power in the 1980s, Nigeria has already started almost 20 years of military rule since General Iranzi took power in the country, and all the problems of federalism in Nigeria, unitary government, military dictatorship became an issue. The American contribution to this narrative is that when the Nigerians broke away from the British system of prime ministership to presidency, many of their intellectuals were beginning to look at the American experiment of federalism as an interesting experiment. The Nigerians have been battling with federalism. It is still not properly done because the military dictatorship changed the narrative. Some Nigerians would like to have federalism, but in actual fact, they like to have the federal government centralized in Lagos, now Abuja. This is where you begin to see how the legacy of Buhari is being tested. The second point that has to be emphasized today is that state building and nation building is still a big test for the Nigerians. The third point that has to be emphasized with regard to all the support and enthusiasm for Buhari. Buhari's first problem is the three P's, what I call the Nyangean three P's: patience, persistence, and persistence. These three P's are going to be the major obstacle for Buhari. The major obstacle to Buhari, if you look at it, and American leaders and policymakers are going to look at Nigeria critically in terms of these three P's, whether the Nigerians are going to be patient enough to help Buhari go through the big task. He is now the new Charles Atlas of Nigerian politics. When Buhari was trying to rule Nigeria, there are some telling stories for Nigerians. At that time, the Nigerian naira was very strong vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar. Today, the relationship is so embarrassing. The Nigerian naira is now almost 200 naira to $1, when once upon a time, it was almost 1 naira to $2. So this becomes very interesting with Buhari. How can Buhari lead the Nigerians democratically, socially, and politically? That is why the third issue that comes in with regard to Buhari and his assumption of the presidency is, will the Nigerians individually and collectively be patient enough to help democracy to work? And this is the last point where the American experience is very important. America has been the longest-lasting republic. From 1776 to now, the Greeks tried, they failed. The Romans tried, they failed. Many other people tried republicanism, and they failed. The American experiment is still here. That's one of the reasons why thousands of Nigerians who got educated in America must give Buhari that most important prize: patience. So when we look at America's relations with Nigeria under Buhari, patience. This should be the message. The last word coming from America to Nigeria is, please develop the language of patience, persistence, and perseverance. And please, please, please learn to budget your emotions. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, William Andrade, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, the dance of a millipede does not impress the person who has seen the dance of a snake. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is not a coincidence that countries are more stable and prosperous when women enjoy rights that are comparable to those of men, and when women participate in governance and in the formal economy. These countries are also less vulnerable to the impacts of violent extremism. This is a phenomenon we see across the globe, wrote U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues Catherine Russell in a recent blog post. Economies are stronger when women are in the labor force and afforded the same opportunities as men. Outcomes from peace negotiations are better when women have seats at the table. Countries are more stable when women are valued and given opportunities to reach their full potential. In the global effort to prevent and counter violent extremism, issues that most affect women are frequently dismissed, and too often women's rights become a bargaining chip. We know that women are key players in preventing violence. Over the years, we have seen that women's leadership and participation in their communities create stability and help build stronger communities that are less prone to conflict. Strong, empowered women are the foundation of strong, prosperous societies. That is why, under the administration of President Barack Obama, advancing the status and empowerment of women and girls around the world has been integrated into U.S. foreign policy. It is time for all of us to recognize that women's empowerment is crucial to the well-being of every society. And it is long past due to recognize that women's issues are issues that deeply affect every society as a whole. The resolution of such issues and women's participation in the process is crucial to every country's prospects for peace and economic stability.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.